out.
Yes, Rabbi.
Thank you. Last time we talked about the third child of Naomi. Naomi was carrying a third child, and that child was miscarried while she was in Moab. And therefore, she has technically three children. She's lost two, Chilion and the Vlad. But Machlon, she's holding out hope for. She's holding out hope for Machlon. And now I got us on Pasuk Vov. I think that's true, right? Section, that's chapter 1, Pasuk Vov. V'tokom hi v'choloseha. And then she arose with her daughters-in-law. V'toshav mishtei Moav. And she returned from the fields of Moab. Why? Kishma b'seder Moav. She had heard on the grapevine while she was in Moab, that Hashem had remembered his people and given them bread. Why doesn't it say that the famine has ended in Israel? Isn't that the whole point? Isn't that why they left? Didn't we say the whole point was in 1:1, if you remember, all the way back there, just like weeks ago or whatever. It was in the days of what happened? They were Ephratites, they came from the fields of Moab and they were there. Why? There was a famine going on. There was a famine. They left because they didn't have any food. So why does it say that God had remembered his people and given them bread? It would be nicer to say the famine ended in Israel. That would be the very first thing. Maybe you could say, why is it necessary to say v'tokom? She arose. Just as she went. What do you mean she got up and left? Remember that? Now, one of the things we discussed last time, I think we already discussed this with you, is she didn't want to hang about. She was not hanging about. She was not going to stay and get persuaded to stay and have a farewell party with balloons saying, "We love you, Naomi," in balloons, custom-made balloons by a new company. And, you know, that she's not doing it. She's getting up and she's going. Right? But notice the singular form, v'tokom, is employed in place of v'tokoimoi. And they arose. We're talking about her and her two daughters-in-law. Well, the answer is she didn't leave with them. She left by herself and ran away. It was her daughters-in-law that ran after her. And I think that's where we got to last time. And then we're talking about Pasuk 7, verse 7, where she left. Literally, she went out. V'teitze min hamokom. Literally means she exited the place where she had been. Her two daughters-in-law with her. They set out on the road to return El Eretz Yehuda, to the land of Judea. So we already said she was in a rush to leave. And we already said last week why she was in a rush to leave. Because she didn't want to get waylaid. She wanted out of there. Now remember, what were some of the reasons as to why she got... Why did everyone die? What were the reasons? Can we just do a little bit of a recap? Why did Elimelech, Machlon and Chilion die? There were various sins that they died for. Can we just try to do some... Why did Elimelech die?
He left his people.
Right, one was he was the most important man in Israel, possibly. Certainly, we say fitting to be anointed as a king of Israel. That's about as good as it gets. And he said, forget that. I don't want to help anyone. I don't want to lose my money. So he ran away. Two is where he ran away to was like Auschwitz. It was like the worst place in the world he could run to. It was a tremendous disgrace. Okay, how long are you going to be there? 10 years, you're going to die. Another reason is, he looked as if he basically got permanent settlement status in Moab, which is disgusting for a person of it. Three is he did not sufficiently guide his children enough not for them to intermarry. You put all this together, Naomi was also partly burdened with this. She also, again, we talked about, was Naomi, she's also sinned in this way. She went with her husband. Okay, they went separately because they separated, because he was so righteous, they separated within a marriage, a framework of marriage. Okay, that's all very good, but she still went and said, well, I'm not leaving. I'd rather die here of starvation than go to Auschwitz, and, you know, and eat full. You know what I'm saying? She didn't do that. And two is, she didn't hold him back. She maybe could have held him back. Three is, I don't know, and she could have certainly had some kind of effect on her children. Now she's leaving. She's leaving to also make amends for the sin that she's aware she's committed. She knows every second she's in Moav, she's over. She's sinning by being there. If there's no good reason for her to be in Moav, there's no good reason for her to be there. She's got to go. The second she heard there's food, she got up and she went. There's now no reason for me to be in Moav. I've got news for you. Why didn't she go earlier? Lots of other Jews didn't leave. We're going to discuss that. Why didn't she go earlier? It's like this. There's a Medrash Rus Rabba that says, why didn't she go earlier? It says like this. When you've got plenty of food and you live comfortably, then you were worried that you might have to share your money with the poor and you'd have too many mouths to feed. That's the Medrash Rabba talking about how Elimelech and Naomi saw their position when the famine kicked in Israel. And people would say that. What right do you have now to leave Moab and come back to us begging for food that we should sustain you while we're still in a famine? She knew that because she left under those auspices, there was a very good likelihood she's going to get that argument to her unless there's plenty of food back in Israel. If anyone's not going to have a lot of food, she's not going to be able to go back there and beg for food. Not now. Now that she left literally with her tail between her legs because she didn't want to spend any money on the poor, how rich is it that she comes back while there's still a famine begging for food? People might not feed her. She might die. So there's good reason for her not to leave Moab until the famine is over, because at least she can offset that argument. There's plenty of food. She doesn't have to beg from anyone. She can glean leket, shicha, and payah, which are the dropped sheaves and straws and corners of a field, which must be left for the poor anyway, at any time. And therefore, she doesn't have to beg for anyone directly, offsetting the terrible and embarrassing argument saying, oh, you want money from me? When I needed money from you, you ran away. So she said it was not right for her to go back while there was still a famine, because they would have a very great argument against her. But it says, the pasuk says, why? Ki fokat Hashem esamoi. Hashem remembered his people. L'seis l'holechem, to give them bread. What does that mean, he remembered his people? Why not just say there was food, the famine was over. Natural occurrences, right? The point is that God remembered his people and not his land. That's what Shmuel and Avi's pointing out. God remembered the people, not the Eretz. This is in contrast, if you look up in Joel 2:18, God was jealous for his land and had pity on his people. Doesn't say that here. He remembered the people. Doesn't say a sausage about the land. Naomi would not have remained outside of Eretz Yisrael in any case. And she hurried to leave now because she wanted to get back to Eretz Yisrael. Now, as far as the land was concerned, she felt no right to take from it, since she had already sinned against the land by not helping make the land more profitable. Now that she felt as if Klal Yisrael, not the land, merited some kind of deliverance, and she still considered herself part of that nation. She's a Jew living in Moab. It's a very important thing for us. You should not see yourself as British, Jewish. You're a Jew residing in Britain at this time. Was it Rabbi Reuben says, Zayda always speaks with an accent. Zayda speaks with an accent. Now, even though many people might say, well, actually my Zayda doesn't, he's got proper English, your Zayda's father or mother or their father probably did speak with an accent. The answer for that is that God is jiggling us around, moving us through the exile to get a job done, and we are not permanent residents in the land to which have we've been exiled. Why is that? If we were, then we wouldn't be exiled. And if you aren't exiled, then exile isn't working. Let me just make that clear again. Exile's a punishment. God has exiled you and me from our homeland because we and our parents' parents have all been naughty. And as we know, any generation which doesn't merit to see the rebuilding of the temple in its day is meritorious to have had the temple destroyed in its day. So exile is a punishment. We've been banished. We've been banished from home, sent from home. Now, if you get really, really comfy at home, oh, I like it in, oh, it's lovely in New York, or it's lovely in Manchester, the leafy suburbs, then you know what you are? You're not in exile. You've got two options. Either you need another punishment, or God needs to move you somewhere else where you are in exile. Otherwise, the prescription of exile isn't working. That's why Zayda speaks with an accent. Because the exile, within about three or four generations, people get very comfy. So God keeps jiggling us around, saying, well, don't get too comfy there. That's not where you're meant to be. Otherwise, this exile thing isn't working, and further punishments are required. One of the reasons we dwell in a sukkah after Yom Kippur is if there's any punishment still awaiting us from the din of Yom Kippur, because we've left our homes and dwelling in a sukkah, that sukkah has the din of Golus, exiled from our home, and therefore Hashem can say, oh, well, look, they've already exiled themselves. I don't have to punish them any further. They're in self-imposed exile, which is a punishment. Therefore, that can soak up any negativity in the din. That's why sukkahs comes directly on the heel of Yom Kippur. In fact, the first thing you're meant to do after Yom Kippur is get on building your exile. Get your exile hut together. Get some exile in. It's good for you. So everyone's back in. What are you doing? I'm living in exile. Now, we do see at the same time, it's the only mitzvah you step inside. I had a clever person say, no, mikvah's also like that. There's no mitzvah dafka to be in the mikvah. There's a mitzvah to be purified by a mikvah. You can't live in a mikvah unless you have gills. The sukkah is a mitzvah you reside in. You live in a sukkah. It's the only mitzvah we live in. That's a fantastic schar. Yes, we get both things. We get the tremendous closeness to Hashem and we get the benefit of exile. That's what we can do here in England. You can feel close to Hashem, feeling that he's still looking after you despite the fact that you've been exiled. But you've got to hit the exile pain. Naomi knows she's exiled, self-imposed. And every second she's in this exile, it's her fault. She's got to get back. The second she can, she will. Otherwise, she might die. She's concerned for her own safety. Ellie, you got your hand up.
Yeah, what about... Sorry to pick on this point, but what about living in Israel?
Yeah.
Isn't living in Israel stepping into a mitzvah?
Yes, that's correct. Every four amos that you walk in Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah on the Jews to dwell in Israel. It's a pasuk in Vayikra, that you've got to live there and sow the land, etc. The question is how come so many people don't? Well, there's very good reason for that. Parnasa, Shiduchim, Chinuch are very important reasons. But if you're there because you feel as if I'm British and I feel allegiance to stay in Britain for these reasons, then something's deeply wrong with your relationship to the Borei Olam. Okay? Is that all right? So is the hand, yeah, you okay with that? Because the hand's up? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I'm okay to continue.
I didn't catch that last sentence that you said.
Which one, Usher?
Just the last sentence. You said on your answer, and I mean, I couldn't hear you.
Okay. I'm not sure which sentence that was. I'll say we have a mitzvah to dwell in the land of Eretz Yisrael. It's a pasuk and vayikra that we have to go in and dwell. However, there are legitimate reasons not to be there. If there are, that has to be done in consultation with the Rav, by the way. You can't just paskin for yourself on this. It's a Duraisa Shaila. So you've got to speak it out with the Rav. Like any Duraisa Shaila with kashrus in meat, if a piece of meat is questionable, you should put it towards your Rav and say, what do I do? Is this stake was found and I'm not sure what the status is. So too, you could just as well live in the land of Eretz Israel, and you're not. You have to sit that down through a rov and find out why you have to go. Sometimes it's right for you to stay in Golus, outside in the diaspora. Sometimes it's right for you to go. It depends. That is a halachic shala like any other. Like, is my arba minim kosher? It shouldn't just be, I like the lifestyle, I don't much like the weather here. That's not what's going on. That's not, look, if that gets you there, it gets you there. But that's not necessarily the reason you should be going there. You're going there because you've got a mitzvah. Yeah? Asher, how do you feel about that? You okay with that? Okay. Now, by the way, Naomi has figured out on the grapevine that for whatever reason she's unaware of, Klal Yisrael in Yehuda, in Israel, in Judea, have merited some kind of deliverance. The tables have certainly turned from the moral decay that led to the famine. And that's why it's interesting that the Elisha, when she, the woman that he bumped into, he said, can I daven for you? He said, I dwell among my people. Naomi says basically the same thing. God has provided them with bread and not me. But this does not mean I'm excluded from eating it, says the Medrash Rabbah. Their prosperity will bring me peace and I'll be blessed along with them. You always go where the bracha is. If she knows that the bracha is happening there, there's nothing stopping her now from going back and chapping a rine on that bracha. Let her also get on that bracha. If the bracha's in Israel, go there. That's what she now knows. She's hearing that. There's no reason, there's not a single reason for her to stay in Moab. So she's seen her husband die. She's seen her children die. She's seen her unborn child die. All as a result of this terrible move. She's out of there. There's nothing keeping her there. Only her daughters in all. She doesn't want to speak to them. She's off. She literally gets up. By the way, it says baderech on the road. Chazal learned out. She was barefoot. She was so destitute. She was literally on the road on her feet. She had no shoes. Very, very, very interesting. Now, after a famine had lasted, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed the land so the seeds germinated extra quickly and the crops could grow quickly. There's a big question. How could she get back in time for the harvest, Shavuos, if she had just heard that the famine had ended? Hashem made it speed up so that that year they had a normal crop, even though there was no food as normal. And therefore, the people could openly say, God's remembered us. Because he's done a miracle for us. He's bent nature to give us a crop earlier than usual. That they can see the brachas in the food. And Naomi heard that. That's the key of what she heard. She heard that Hashem is now willing to do a nes for his people. So she immediately set out once she heard about that. Proof of this, by the way, is later in verse 22. It says they came to Beis Lechem in the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, that period of time marks the onset of the harvesting season. So you can work out that when she set on her way, the crop was still growing in the field. That's when she just heard that there's food. So the text already is indicating that she was not expected to live in luxury because she had heard that there was only bread. God had given bread to his people. No luxuries, staple only. Not fruits and vegetables. And Yehuda, especially the area of Judea, is very well known for having fruits and vegetables. And yet there was no fruits and vegetables. There was only bread. Barley bread, which isn't the nicest of all breads. But even for that, she left the fertile fields of Moab for the barley bread in Israel. That's a merit. That's a merit. That's what's going to keep her alive. That merit of getting up, leaving luxury for difficulty for the love of Eretz Yisrael is going to see her through the din over her head that is the same as Elimelech and Machlon Chinon marrying out. So she's working with this concept of din. Any question up till there? All right. Now it says, very interestingly, if you look carefully, last thing on these pasukim, it says, V'tokom hi v'choloseha, she arose with her daughter-in-law. It doesn't say she went with them. Her daughters-in-law came to be with her. They didn't know what she was doing. She was going. She didn't reveal where she was going. She was just going for a walk. She left very suddenly, and they accompanied her unaware of any intention. There is no doubt that originally they had planned only to escort her, because they had a deep attachment and respect for her, despite her being destitute at this stage. But it was only Naomi alone who decided to leave Moab behind forever and return to her people. She's saying, I'm out of here. I'm leaving to get my schus back, to get my merit back. Only once they had left the city limits and they were well on their way outside of the city of Moab, did Naomi say, you know, I ought to level with you. I have no plan on turning around. I'm going back to Israel. And it was then, at that moment, outside of Moab, that's what it means, they arose and left Moab, not knowing what they were doing. Then Naomi said, you know what? I'm going to go to Israel. They said, you know what? We'll come with you. We'll come with you. Especially after she had explained to them the reasons for why she left. They felt camaraderie because of Machlon and Chilion. Well, let's go with mum-in-law. So they set out Bederech on the road, barefoot. And only after they got some way from the town did they decide to go to Judah. That's the understanding of these verses. Then it's verse 8. Verse 8. So we're on 1-8. So let's do 8 and 9. While we're here, let's double up here. Let's look at Vatoma Naomi. Lishtecha lo seha. Said Naomi to her two daughters-in-law, Rabboisai, we're reading this closely. Why on earth do we need to be told there's two daughters-in-law? Did we not know there was Ruth and Orpah? Who are these two daughters-in-law? Just say with your daughters-in-law. I know how many there are. You've already established that in the text for me. Amazing. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law. Like, who else would you be saying it to? Go back. Go back. Each return, notice. Leves imoh. To the house of your mothers. That's strange, isn't it? Don't you say the house of your father? What's going on there? May God deal kindly with you as he dealt with the dead and with me. What kindness has been dealt with the dead? What kindness? May God grant that you find peace, each one in your husband's home. What, is it your husband's home or your mother's home? You need to pick, because in verse 8, you said your mother's house. And in verse 9, you now say your husband's house. She kissed them and they cried loudly. They're having a really weepy moment now. Now, there's lots and lots to discuss here. I mean, something's afoot. Okay. What's going on? Go to the house of your mother. Do we ever say that? Is that ever mentioned? Naomi was saying a very important thing. She was saying, go back. Go back. She said, this is the key. Had you have both converted to Judaism, it would have been out of place to return to your father's houses. Because once you're converted, you're no longer part of their family. And we learn that out from a Gemara in Yevamos, Chof Beis Omed Beis, that's 22b. That a Gentile, we learn out from Yisroi, actually, Jethro. Very interesting, very complicated thing about Jethro. That once you convert, you're no longer halachically related to your biological parents and family. Your new parents are your conversion parents. Very interesting concept. One who becomes a ger is like a newly born child. That's a Gemara. How could you be expected to return to your parents' homes once you're Jewish if you're no longer related to them? So what's going on? Besides, the atmosphere in such a home would feel very uncomfortable if you want to lead a Yiddish life. Their father was Egloin, king of Moab, and he did not keep a Torah home, okay? Just to put it mildly. You're not going to feel comfortable going back to such a house. But since you've not converted, there's no reason why you can't both return to your mother's house. For you still belong to your respective families. what's going on? When they married Machloin and Chilion, they underwent a quickie conversion, which is a conversion out of fear so that it would allow the marriage to go ahead. She is now stating, if you want to hold that you're both Jewish, I can't tell you to go back to Eglon's house because that you're not technically related to Eglon's house. But really, the conversion you converted when you got married wasn't legally acceptable. Therefore, why can't you both return to your mother's house? Because you at least are biologically still related to your families, even though in a certain respect, philosophically, you may have left your father's ideals to live as quasi-Jews for a bit, but your mother's certainly your mother. Al pi halacha, your mum's still your mum. Maybe your father's no longer your father, because we say the father is the one that gives over the philosophical ideas to the children. So she says, at least your mother's, according to all opinions, whether you did convert or whether you didn't convert, you can go back to your mother's house. You'd feel comfortable there. Naomi was specifically using the term the mother's house because she wished to show her distaste for male Moabites. The Torah has said you can't accept a Moabite into the nation of Israel. I don't like them, says God. She says, I would never tell you to go back to a male Moabite house because the Torah tells you not to do that. A Moabitess, a woman, is permitted to marry a Jew. So your mother is more kosher than your father. Go back to your mother's house. I can't tell you to go back to your father's house. Yuck. Ah. But your mum, you know, there's hope for your mum. Maybe she'll marry a Jew. There's another thing as well. Do you mind me going into a second bit about this? Little thing. I can't hear you. When we don't do Zoom and we're in face-to-face, people go, no, yeah, no. On Zoom, you just get people shooting. I don't know. I'm just going to do it. I don't know. It's like this. First of all, this what's really interesting here is she actually had already felt paternal feelings to these two women, says the Medrash. The Medrash says she felt like their mother. They'd married her sons. She now saw Rus and Orpah like daughters, mummish as daughters. So she had been a mother to them. That's why it made it difficult for her to part from them. Go back to your real mother's house. Even though I feel like your mother, go back to your biological mother. That's why she's also talking about Imeho. Secondly, if she left them, they would be like trees that shed their leaves. Each of them would return to her mother's house, lonesome, dejected and with little appetite for life. They'd feel like birds without trees, as it were. Even if their father were to provide them with food, it would be like Nahama de Kasufa, a bread of shame, because they feel as if they don't belong anymore. They miss and they're going to pine for Naomi. So their father's not going to really help them, even if he gives them money and food. He says, at least your mother will give you some comfort. Go to your mother's house. Let her comfort you and give you the comfort that you want from me as your mother-in-law. Do you hear what she's saying here? It's an emotional nourishment. Your mothers will give you what you want from me. I'm your mother-in-law. Go to your mother and get that from her. There's lots of reasons why I should say don't go back to your father. One is your father's not going to emotionally give you what you want by standing here weeping with me. Two is I'm never going to tell you to go to a Moabite. Three is you might have actually gone through a conversion. We're not so sure, in which case your father isn't your father anymore. There's lots of reasons not to say go back to your father's house. Very wise. She's really got her head on her shoulders, Naomi, what she's saying here. She's really seeing things very holistically. She's trying to put them at ease, saying go back to your mum's house and you'll feel better there. Now, regarding this first factor, that I treated you like my very own daughter, surely the mothers who bore you will treat you even better than I will. You'll enjoy their company more than you do me. That's why she says go back to your mother's house. Second, they were reluctant to return. They were starting to cry to say we don't want to go back now. So she says there's no purpose in you feeling like beggars. God is not going to withhold any reward. I'm certain that God will deal kindly with you and ensure that you will not have to rely solely upon your mothers for survival. It's going to be better with your mothers than it is with this mother, i.e. me. So she's shunning them to go back to their birth parents. This is the first stage in turning them away from conversion. God, he's saying, if you want to join the family of Klal Yisrael, you are going to feel like aliens and strangers. And I don't want that for you, and you don't want that for you, so go home. Go home. You're going to have it better. She's shunning them. I.e., this is already on the conversion track. Is everyone okay with this so far? Any questions? Okay, is everyone all right? So already we now see the way Naomi is relating to Ruth and Orpah is as a quasi-Kirov, quasi-Gerus question as to, you know what, I think you'll find it better with those people, go live there. But they're pushing, they're not leaving her. Like a Ger says, no, I want to, actually, I know you're telling me to go home. I want to stick it out, I want to join you. It's not so simple. We have to see where you're holding. Now we're starting to talk about, this is now getting into the Gerus track. So there's a Medrash Rabba on Rus 2.13. And it says that Rus and Orpah prepared the burial shrouds for their husbands and relinquished any claim to the entitlement they were due upon their husband's death in favor of their mother-in-law, which was a most pious and charitable act for two Gentile princesses to do. Thus you have dealt kindly with the dead. Look at verse 9. You know what? Just look at verse 8. Can you see verse 8? Chesed ka'asher asisem im hamesim ve'imodi. God will deal kindly with you as you dealt kindly with the dead and with me. Notice the word asisem is in the masculine form. Asisem is masculine. Why? Says the Alshech HaKadosh, because they did the work of men. It's for men to do Chevra Kadisha work, not women. Women aren't on the Chevra Kadisha. They don't do that so much. They aren't mummish on it directly. It's men that have to dig the graves, and certainly men for men. This is Machlon Achelion. Who's covering them and putting burial shrouds on them and burying them? Two women, their wives. That's what she said, Osisim. You two women have done the work of men. And you've done kindness with them, not only in the way that you buried them, but in the fact you gave any inheritance to me and not to yourselves, which you were legally due. That's what it means you've dealt kindly with the dead and with me. You buried them. Psh. On account of that, says Naomi, God will surely deal kindly with you. Go home. It'll be fine with you at home. So Naomi was giving them a brocha. She was saying, because you did such a magnanimous act of chesed, asisem, men's act of you, stuff that men should be doing, not you, and certainly doing it better, you know, that they wouldn't be doing it as good as you're doing it. I'm sure when you go home to your mother, you will get all the brochas in the world and you'll both be very happy at home. So don't worry.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Presumably they did it because there were no Jewish men to do it.
That's not the point. Why didn't they get the regular men of Moab to do it?
They're not able to do it to give a Jewish burial.
What do they know about a Jewish burial? Do you know how to bury people according to Jewish law? Most people don't. It's very specific laws. It's tough. There's all kinds of cleaning processes and how you shroud them and what they wear, how they're meant to be buried. A whole Yiddish kvura was all oversighted by Naomi. But at the end of the day, these women, out of their own purses and their own finances, decided to do something which was crazy intense level of chesed. She said, you have done way beyond your call of duty here. And the truth is that the second these men died, technically, you're not even Jewish anymore. I mean, your whole claim to Judaism is because you're married to these two. Now they're dead, you could bury them according to Moab ritual. What difference is there? The fact is, you both decided to give them a burial that was fitting for their religious background. And you forfeited your claim to your inheritance and gave it to me, which is ridiculous. That is going to mean that when you turn around and go back home to your mother's house, it'll go really well for you. Hashem will give you the reward. Hashem will give you that reward. It'll all work out well. It'll be great. She's saying you're definitely in line for great reward. Go home and enjoy it. You don't want to come with me and end up begging for food, you know, in a, like, or walking around in a field picking up poor people's rations. Go to your princely status, your princesses, and enjoy it. And Hashem will give you a big brocha. She's sending them away with mazel and brocha. Sounds good. They weren't shaking. Both of them were not cutting loose from Naomi, and they seemed to feel as if they were now more attached to Naomi than they were to their own birth parents, which is most strange. Now, it's not so strange for one of them. Remember, Rus, coming back, is the good dove from Moab, which has been set aside all the way from Lot, that specifically got to get this done. She is magnetically attracted to Naomi to be able to join Klal Yisrael to fulfill her life mission. Orpah is kind of orbiting around as well. But they're certainly in a situation where they feel unusual dedication to a life path of bitterness and difficulty. Okay. By the way, Naomi comes from the word Na'am, which means pleasing, because Rus Rabbah says that her ways were pleasing to everyone. And she was a very great woman, and therefore they were attracted to her greatness, despite the fact she was destitute. By the way, the word Rus is Ra'asa, she saw. She saw in Naomi a very great woman, despite the fact that she was old, decrepit, and destitute. And she was willing to see through that and see the greatness and aspire to that greatness. Now it says on Pasuk Tes, Yitain Hashem Lochem, may Hashem grant that you find peace, each one in your husband's house. What's going on with these husbands? I don't know, is it husbands, is it mothers? Is anyone please going to make a decision as to whose house she's sending them to? What is going on? Is it just me? Or is this, what's going on? What is going on? Says the Medrash Rabbah on Rus Rabbah 2:15, Rav Yossi says, all the benefits and consolations that God would offer Solomon, as it is written, and God gave wisdom to Solomon, will derive from you. When Naomi said, may God grant you, she's talking to Rus and Orpah, saying all the brachas of Shlomo, may they devolve upon you. Because Naomi was aware that one of these two women was the good dove coming from Moab that would build up Malchus Beis David. She knew that. It was a tradition. She didn't know which one, but she knew one of them was harboring this secret key. The problem is, she gave both daughters-in-law a blessing, even though she knew that only one of them was destined to come from it. Naomi's words contain a great deal more than the obvious. Chazal are saying, again in Rus Rabbah 2:15, that her revealed words are, may God deal kindly with you. This always refers to conversion. Thus they maintain Ya'aseh. Ya'as has a silent hay, to signify that a proselyte undergoes many tribulations and much suffering. Everyone that I've met that has done an off-the-street conversion, literally they walk into a Beis Din saying, I want to be Jewish, has got a story to tell. They've all had a very hard time. And a Kodesh Baruch Hu puts them through the mill to see whether or not they are truly dedicated to join his people. They further revealed, Chazal are further revealing in Rus Rabbah, that the words, God will grant you, refer to the kingdom of David. She blessed them by saying, may God grant you. She's saying, Malchus Beis David. She doesn't know to which one of these girls is going to get it. But one of them is going to be a fitting response. Now we can go. When it says, go, return, when she turned around and says, go, return, which is in Pasuk Ches, when she said, go back, go, return to your mother's house. What was she saying? Go to your homes. However, if you wish to convert, come with me and return. This is very similar, by the way. After the sin of the golden calf, God said to Moses, "Leave me now and I will destroy them in an instant. And I will make a great nation out of you. I've had enough. I'm sick of it." So what did Moshe Rabbeinu do? He didn't leave. He got the hint, right? Hashem was giving him a hint. Leave me now and I'll destroy them. But if you don't leave, I won't. So he didn't, and he davened. There was a subtext there. It's kind of, if you leave me, then I'm going to destroy Klal Yisrael. But if you don't, maybe you can put forth a good argument to save them. So too, Naomi is saying the same thing to Ruth and Orpah. Go home now and don't convert. Or stay and convert. The choice is yours. To convey that, she adds to your mother's house, not your father's house, because she doesn't want them to go back to a Moabite, because it's not right for a Yiddish girl to go to a Moabite man. That's also part of the hint there. Go to your mother's house, because I would never tell you go to a Moabite house if your good Yiddish girls are going to come home. If you are going to convert, then definitely you should stay with me. However, continues Naomi, that hardly suffices, because as converts, you're going to find it difficult to lead a Jewish life in a Moabite household that is based on ideas contrary to your beliefs. And she spoke to both of them, blessing them that they be repaid kindness that they did in providing the shrouds for their husband's burial. In addition, they gave up their entitlements. She says, may Hashem repay you for the kindness you did with me. Rabbosai, if someone is going to convert to Judaism and they approach you as the individual to say, I'd like to join Judaism, what's the first thing you would tell them about in Judaism that you should get to grips with as a Gentile that's converting? It's an
613 laws. The Torah given by Hashem to Moshe.
Okay. So Adrian says you would sit them down with a table for a few days and go through entire Sefer Chinuch and teach them to us. That's a long call. Clive wants to say you should tell them the Torah came from God. Anything else you'd want to mention to a newbie in Judaism as to what's important?
You should love your neighbor as yourself.
Oh, Hillel. Okay, that's very nice. I would have thought it would have been things like Shabbos, Kashrus, Taharas Mishpacha, the big three, you know what I mean? You want to join Judaism?
There's the laws that I was saying, that instead of having to keep seven laws, they can now keep 613 laws.
Yeah, but which ones are you going to tell them first, Adrian?
No, there is no first.
Well, she's not going to be able to... She's not going to stand on one foot and go through 613 laws. If someone is new to Judaism, what are the first things you would tell them about Judaism? That's what I'm asking you.
The main ones, I think, are the three. Keeping Shabbat, keeping Tehara, and...
Kashrut.
Kashrut, yeah.
Yeah, that's what everyone would say. If you learn about Judaism, maybe Shabbos, Kashrus, Taharas Mishpacha. Come on, the big ones, yeah? You know the first thing she told them? This is unbelievable. It's my worth coming moment. You know, I have to pepper in a worth. Every week I have a worth coming moment that says you should give up your time. It's a worth coming moment. This is unbelievable. The Medrash Rabbah says on this pasuk, you know what she told them? She said, Jews don't go to circuses or theatres. Yeah, we don't do that. You want to be Jewish, we don't do that. Hello, that's not even law. That's a custom. It's not even law. It's not law. That's what Rashi says. In Egypt, the place was teeming with Jews. The Torah says that. Rashi says in the theatres and the circuses. In theatres and circuses, which is places Jews shouldn't be. That's what it means, it teemed with them. Of all the things in the world, could you find less important things to mention than don't go to a nightclub and don't go to theatres and don't go to cinemas. For goodness sake, is there nothing else to think about? Oh, very good, says Michael Krebs. Michael Krebs is saying, you know, it's like, that's a big deal, isn't it? It says like this, a very interesting idea of Shimon Schwab brings down on Megillus Rus as follows. He says like this. He says there's obviously certain rules which any Jew that's new to Judaism has to know to follow. But for a Gentile entering Jewish behaviour, there's also a certain social etiquette to be considered a mamleches kohuna goy kodosh. You want to be a nation of Kohens, a nation of priests, a holy people to me. There's a certain behavioural difference which is no longer going to cut it as you have been a Gentile. This has nothing to do with Shabbos Tarsus, Shprocha, Kashrus, Yom Kippur, anything like that. Where you go, how you walk, how you dress, how you talk, how you interface, you've got to be on board with this Klal Yisrael business. There's a certain frame of mind, which means what's going on in nightclubs and cinemas and regular theatres is not for the Ben Tyra. It's not for those that are aspiring to be a Kohen to God. You want to be an Amli Segula. You want to be a treasured nation to God himself. There's a different way of walking. And I'm warning you here, for a Moabite princess, the circuses and theatres are going to be a problem for you too. That's a good way to talk to a convert. Even though they are almost irrelevant from a day-to-day living Judaism basis, they are extremely profound behavioural changes for a person who's not yet in the fold of Judaism. First thing she told them was something that was only a custom. Just to feel out the waters as to where these two were holding. You want to come with me, you can go to your mother's house. You want to come with me, things like circuses and theatres and all the things you're used to, they're off the books now. It's off the menu. Are you sure you want to turn around and walk with me? That's a very clever thing to say. Rav Shimon Schwab says that's a very, very clever thing to say. And they said, Sid Rus, where you go, I will go. If you're not going to go to the cinema and you're not going to go to the theatre, then I'm not going to do it either. Then she says, we shouldn't worship idols. What? Have you ever heard of the seven Noahide laws? These are the laws of which all Jews and Gentiles are bound to. They're brought in a Gemara Sanhedrin and in Rambam, Hilchos Melachim, that is Sanhedrin 56a, and it's the laws of Kings 9:1. Here are the seven Noahide laws. Number one, out of seven, you cannot worship idols. Number two, you've got to daven to Hashem. When you daven to Hashem as a Gentile, what name of God do you have to use? What name of God have the Gentiles got to call God by? It's Elokei Yisrael. They have to daven to God as the God of Israel because God has devolved his name upon us. And for the Gentiles, they have to say he's their God. We're his ambassadors. He says, you want to know me? I'm their God. That's the name of God Gentiles have to approach God with. Elokei Yisrael. O God of Israel, hear me now. He's the God of the Israelites. His honour is you. You are his honour. As far as all the Gentiles in the world are, you are the one he bestows. For a Gentile mind, you're a Jew. Are you an Israelite? I daven to your God. Yeah, that's right. Shavu Mitzvos B'nei Noach. Three is no murder. Four, all kinds of sexual transgressions. Five, theft and all civil law. Six, you have to set up courts of jurisprudence to set up to make sure this is enforced. And seven, you cannot be cruel to animals. Which means they were certainly aware they shouldn't be worshipping idols as Gentiles, let alone as Jews. Jews are allergic to idol worship. What did she mean? Rav Shimon Schwab says as follows. There's an unbelievable Gemara that he quotes and says like this. It's a Gemara Shabbos 105b. What does it mean? There should be no strange god with you. You shall not bow before an alien god. If an individual gets angry to such an extent that he rips his clothes, smashes his property, or scatters his own money, it's as if he's worshipping idols. It says, if he's an idol worshipper, what does that mean? What does that mean? He says like this. Says this from Shimon Schwab. Complete allegiance to God does not mean only that one not bow before external idols. One must also not allow himself to be so controlled by his feelings to act illogically and destructively. One who can be goaded by his anger to the point that he's out of control is considered to be serving an idol within his own self, and that his actions can be said now not to be under his sole authority. He's literally out of control. His own anger and lusts are his idol. After Naomi informed Ruth and Orpah about where they can go and can't go, the next thing they said is you can't worship idols. She didn't mean external. They knew that. They for sure knew that when they did this early conversion, when they married Machlon and Chilion. What she meant was, is we're bidden to make God our sole authority, and every action must be subservient to his will in all circumstances. This was the idolatry she's saying. It's forbidden for us to engage in idolatry. And it was this call for complete subservience that Ruth said, your God is my God. Where you go, you're not going to go to the theatre. You're not going to go to the movie theatre. Where you go, I go. Oh, you can't worship idols. What does that mean? You can't lose control of yourself. You've got to be an Eved Hashem. Every one of your movements has to be in line with what it means to be a Jew. Your God will be my God. However you worship, that's however I'm doing it. If you're not going to lose control, I'm going to control myself. See, that's already the tenets of Judaism coming. That's the outcome. It's the product. The product of what the Torah does for you are these very high-level refinements. She's saying that's what we're aiming for, ladies. That's what we're aiming for. How do you feel about that? They're like, we'll go with you. If that's what you're telling us to do, that's what we're going to do. You hear this? How deep is this? Well, the Tyra really is going to... If you keep this Tyra malarkey, Shabbos, Kashrus, Tahar Mishpacha, Yom Kippur, I don't know, Sukkah, whatever, all the Tyra, right? Pesach, you clean your house with a Hoover, and you do all that. What are you going to get out of it? As Rabbi Nachman Bulman, Zocher Tzadik Livracha, said, the hallmark of Tyra education is sensitivity for others and control of oneself. That's what you really get out of the Tyra. This closeness to God is only going to be applicable if you've developed control of your own self and a sensitivity to others. And that's something which the Goy Shevelt does not promote as something to do in life. It's not an important thing on the Gentile list of priorities. And therefore, I'm telling you, you're going to find this really hard, but this is really what we're aiming for. And they say, where you go, where we'll go. Your God will be mine. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. We're going to talk about that. Where you can sleep, you've got Yichud, Hilchas Yichud. She said you can't be alone with a man. Where you sleep, I'll sleep. I.e. these laws that are directly applicable to a woman and how this is going to change her life, she's just going straight to brass tacks. This is what we're expecting of you. Are you sure this is a path you want to go and you want to turn around and walk with me to Judea? You got all these, no circuses, no theatres, no cinemas, no losing control, no licentious behaviour. That's what she's telling them. Things which are very high level refinements. They go, we get it. We get the idea. We get the general gist of it. Just one word. Can I do the word menucha with you? In Pasuk Tes, it says, Yitain Hashem lochem umitzel menucha isha beis isha. Says like this, may God grant that you find menucha, equanimity, peace, relaxation. What's this menucha? Menucha is actually an allusion to Levirate marriage, yibum. Naomi was hinting that one of these sisters-in-law could marry a relative of her dead husband, and one of them would convert and become a wife of a nobleman. And from that progeny would emerge a man who would eventually become the king of Israel. So she's saying the menucha is the rest to the soul of one of my children through being reincarnated through the act of Yibam. May you find rest. May the soul which is fluttering within you, either chilyoin or machloin, which is causing you internal distress, come to rest in a reincarnated soul out of your body and give you that rest that you're not aggravated by this spiritual soul irking at your insides, desperately wanting some kind of, giving you some kind of deep feeling seated uncomfortableness that is happening to you. May that menucha come to you through Yibam. She's saying, may Yibam actually happen. Now, she doesn't know which one, Machlon and Chilion, as yet, are going to be the ones to be reincarnated, but she knows only one of these two girls are going to actually be the special good dove that we've got coming from Moav. So she doesn't know yet who it's going to. So that's why she says to both of them, may you all get the menucha. I don't know which one's going to get it. May you both have it. I don't know which one's going to get it. And she kissed them and cried loudly. These two sisters-in-law realized that Naomi was about to take leave of them, and they started weeping because the soul of Machloin and Chilion inside of them was terrified that if they don't walk along with Naomi, they're going to die for all eternity. The souls inside these women knew what this meant. This is a cataclysmic moment in their life. Unless we go and we convert and we have Yibam, we're going to die forever and ever and ever. So they started crying. The women externally started crying. Then comes the kiss. Naomi is feeling out spiritually with a kiss goodbye who wants to stick and who wants to split. The kiss for Orpah was purely physical. But as for Rus, her neshama found some kind of common link with Naomi, and Naomi and Rus felt it at that time. We see that Orpah kissed her mother-in-law again. Still, she double kissed. She went back and kissed just to make sure. Still, Naomi felt nothing. Their spirits could not unite. But when she felt Rus cleave to her, that's the moment in this verse, in verse 9, that she knew Rus is the one, my son Chilion will die forever. That's why Naomi wept. She was going to weep for one of them. She didn't know who until verse 9. Once she knew that it was Orpah that was going to not cling to her, now she knows she's losing her son Chilion. There's hope for only one of her children, and it's Chilion that's going to bite the bullet. There's so much going on here. Next time, what I'd like to do with you is talk to you about the concept of Yibam as it is in the Torah, in Devarim Parshas Kisaitse, which I think is chapter 20, Deuteronomy 25.5 in Deuteronomy, and that's where Yibam is. But the Yibam that Rus was doing with Boaz was not a regular Yibam, because there were no brothers alive. So we need to learn all about what Yibam was actually going on here. It was a form of extra legal Yibam. We have to understand what's going on and why it was happening that way. But now we're starting to see a scene develop with Gerus, with Yibam, with soul repatriation, with Naomi trying to get back to Eretz Yisrael, realizing that this is her ticket out at this moment. And now is the make or break moment for Rus and Orpah. And that's why in verses 10, 11, 12 and 13, which are like a chunk, she's now going to do the famous turn the ger away business. She's now going to go turn back, even though she knows she's kissed Rus. She knows Rus is the one. She turns around to Rus included and says to both of them in verse 12, both of you go home. Both of you go home. I know that one of you is now the good dove. I know my own son, Machlon's life is resting on this. And still she says, turn round, because we can only do sincere geras. We can only do sincere conversion. You can only come with me if you're absolutely committed. So she's going to turn them away, even though that means now losing her other son forever. That's a big deal. Rabbi Say, thank you so, so much for setting aside this hour. Are there any questions at all? I'm happy to field them now. That is a theory which the tradition that she had received was that there was going to be one good dove coming from Moab. Now, you're right. It could be the one good dove could be Rus, and Orpah could be a perfectly good Gioress as well, in which case she gets to keep both. But she knew right from the get-go that's very unlikely. It's unlikely any of them are going to do it, let alone both of them. Even one of them, you're lucky to chat this good dove. But she had in mind, what about the tradition about the good dove? I wonder which one of these two it would be. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Catch a good dove by its toe, kind of thing. But even then, it could be that neither of them are going to do it. They're both going to turn around, and Machan and Chinah are going to be lost forever, and it's going to have to be some other woman. There was no saying that it was going to be one of these two women, but she was keeping her hopes up. Now, you could turn around and say, hold on, we could have a win-win. It could be one of them is a good dove and the other one Magaz as well. Yeah, but you know what? It's a tough call. Get real Geras at absolute sincerity is a tough call for anyone, let alone a double win. The likelihood is that the good dove is going to want to convert because she's a good dove. That's the only reason she's going to want to convert. If they're not good doves, they're probably just going to walk off and go home. Because what reason would their neshamas have to cleave to Tyra? What a difficult, tough time. What a waste of time. Remember, the Gentiles were asked by God, do you want the Tyra? And they went, no, because we don't like the idea. So why should now these people want to convert? It's very unlikely anyone's going to want to convert. The only reason one of them might convert is because one of them might be the good dove. She's hoping out that one of them is. Doesn't know that either of them is. When she kissed Rus, she had a very good suspicion that Rus is this Moabite dove that the Torah's been talking about. Now, that doesn't mean she's giving up or not, but remember, she turns Rus away as well. In verse 12, she's going to say, Rus, go home. Because you need this for Geras. That's a tough call. You might want to shake her and go, Naomi, don't do this. That's Rus. You can't let her slide. Make an exception with her. By the book. By the book. If she's the right one, she'll make it. Bit of a risk and losing your own son forever. You want to take that risk? At this stage, she's lost so much. What difference does it make? I don't know. Do you hear what I mean? Halavai, all these people want to flock to Jew. Geras is a tough call for anybody. Off the street, Geras. Two for one, very unlikely. Even one is unlikely. If it's one, it's only because she's the good dove. That's how unlikely it is. And Moab is not a nation known for their great etiquette. Them turning up to Torah Judaism is a very unusual thing. The men are barred forever. Women can, but don't know about many of them. So these two happening is very unlikely. That's all. Yes, you're right. Possibly it could happen. Extremely unlikely. Any other questions?